Last week, we didn't get to everything that I wanted to get to, so hopefully we'll do that tonight. If you would, just do me a favor and keep your questions tonight confined to the subject, as it were. I will happily field any and all questions, you know that, which is why the largest section of our website is the Q&A section, because people just keep sending us questions. And there's always a contingency of the room, a contingent in the room, that are just really into the subject we're teaching on at that moment. And then there's the other contingent in the room that's going, wow, that reminds me of something I've always wanted to ask. So, Jim, and then we go chasing that rabbit trail because I always answer questions. So, tonight we're going to try to get through one big topic. We're just going to try to talk about the day of the Lord. Last week I introduced you to the Thlipsis Megas. Wrote it up on the board for you. Anybody remember how to spell that? The Thlipsis, Thlipsis in English letters. Megas, M-E-G-A-S, whom my daughter Megan was named after. Yes, I call her Thlipsis Megan. Thlipsis is the Greek word that means squeezing or compressing. It is the picture of squeezing a grape to get the juice out of it for wine or any reason that you might want to get juice out of a grape. Our word tribulation comes from the Latin word tribulum that was used to translate thlipsis. Tribulum means a beating for the purpose of separation. It was a picture word used when a woman would beat a rug to get the dust out of it, or you would beat the wheat so that the chaff would be separated from the actual meat inside it you could eat. That's that word tribulum. So they chose the word tribulum, beating for separation purposes, to translate thlipsis, which means a pressing or a squeezing, and it's that picture of pressing and squeezing that is the reason that the book of Revelation talks about the wine press of God's wrath. You know what a wine press is? It's a big vat that they would put all of the grapes in, and then they would squish the grapes, either by walking on them or by putting a large stone on them. They would push down on the grapes. And Jesus took that exact terminology, that exact idea, and said the wrath of God was exactly like that, that it would be a squeezing and a pressing down and a blood flowing, very much like thlipsis as a pressing or a squeezing would be. And what I did was I took us to Jeremiah 30 last week. We're not going there, so don't turn there. We started at Daniel 12, 1-4, and I showed you where Daniel said that there was a time of trouble coming on the earth such as never was or ever would be again, right? And then I said he learned that from Jeremiah 30, verses 1-7, and we went and we read a whole bunch of Jeremiah. We spent the rest of the evening in Jeremiah looking at God talking about this time of, and he said it was specific, a time of Jacob's trouble. And the way that he saw it was all men walking around bent over, holding their stomachs in pain as if they were about to give birth, was the picture Jeremiah saw. All men bent over and racked in pain. And he said, what is this time of trouble that would be like this? A time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again. So you've got Daniel and Jeremiah both referring to this time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again. Jeremiah calls it the time of Jacob's trouble, which is a very important phrase. This isn't a time necessarily focused on the whole world as much as it is focused on God dealing with Israel, his children, who he is now going to gather together, bring back, reestablish as a nation. Christ comes back and establishes that kingdom we've been talking about so much. But in order to get from here to that kingdom, Israel is going to go through the thlipsis, the squeezing. Now, the reason that I put thlipsis megas up there is that Jesus drew a distinction between tribulation, because he did say, in this world you'll have tribulation. So there are folk out there who got a hold of that and said, well, the tribulation Jesus was talking about is just the trouble you have in the world, because he said, in this world you'll have tribulation. But Jesus made a distinction where he talked about, yes, in this world you will have trouble, you will have thlipsis, you will have tribulum. But that was distinct from thlipsis megas. And of course, we get mega, the ultimate, the big one, from the Greek word megas. The thlipsis megas is translated the great tribulation. And that's what we're going to look at now, is Jesus saying that there was a time of trouble coming on the earth such as never was or ever would be again, tied into Daniel, tied into Jeremiah. So go there. Let's start at Matthew 24, 15. And then we'll look at the parallel version over in Mark. So start in Matthew 24, Starting at verse 15, now the people Jesus is talking to have this background in Jeremiah. They have this background in Daniel. He's told them, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel, when you see him setting up that image in the temple in Jerusalem, then flee into the wilderness. So he's very much using Daniel as the basis for his comments here in Matthew 24, and you have to recognize that. Starting at verse 15, when you therefore see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel, stand in the holy place. Whoever reads, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which are in Judea flee into the mountains. I've pointed out to you before that that is very Hebrew language. If you're living in, say, Oklahoma, that doesn't mean much to you because you're not there where the abomination of desolation is being set up. If you're in Paris, if you're in Uruguay, if you're anywhere but Judea, you're not going to see the abomination of desolation set up in the temple. This also means a couple of things. Jesus has predicted at the beginning of chapter 24 the destruction of the temple. He's already said, there won't be one stone left here that isn't thrown down. There won't be one stone left on top of another, the destruction of the temple. And then he says, future tense. Now, when you see the abomination of desolation set up in the temple, well, that's got to give you a clue. You got to know then there's another temple coming. And until that temple is built, there can't be the abomination of desolation set up in the temple, which means that Jesus is clearly referring here to Daniel's 70th week. The time when the little horn will make a 7-year peace pact that will include the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem, and halfway through it, he'll break that deal, set up the image of himself in the temple, cause everyone to worship him. So it's a very consistent theology all the way through here. Verse 16, then they that are in Judea will flee into the mountains. Now let him which is up on a housetop not come down to take anything out of the house. In other words, when you see this man, get out. When you see it, don't hang around. Remember how Lot was when it was time to get out of Sodom? And he was, well, I need this. You know, well, I need. And the angel that said finally took him by the hand and said, let's go. I don't have time for this. Let's go. Doesn't matter what you left behind. It's all going to burn. Let's move. And out they went. Same image here. Let him that is on the housetop not come down and take anything out of his house. Neither let him that's out in the field return to take any of his clothes. Whatever you got on, boy, when you hear that the abomination of desolation is set up in the temple, move. Why? Because the Thlipsis Megas is beginning. Head for Edom, Moab, Ammon. The three places that Daniel, which he just referenced, the three places Daniel said the Antichrist won't touch, the place in the wilderness that Revelation 12 tells us the woman will be cared for 1,260 days when she flees into the wilderness. It's consistent theology all the way across. Neither let him that's in the field return to take any clothes, verse 19, and woe to them that are with child, woe to them that give suck in those days. It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard traveling. It's going to be difficult, but get up and go. Now look at verse 20, and pray ye that your flight isn't in the winter, yeah, because it'd be really cold, neither on the Sabbath day. Now there's a clue. Who is he talking to here? He's talking to people, yeah, Jews, people in Judea. Do you care if you travel on a Saturday? No. But if you happen to be a Judean Jew that's still trying to keep the law, and you're still following Moses, and you're still trying to accomplish your righteousness by keeping the Sabbath, you're going to have a huge crisis of conscience if you go, oh no, there's that abomination of desolation thing that Jesus talked about that's in the Bible that Daniel, our own prophet, talked about. Even if I don't believe the Jesus thing, Daniel said it was going to happen, and there it is, and I need to get out of here, but it's Saturday and I can't travel. That's rough for me. Jesus said, well then pray it doesn't happen that day. For then shall be, why? You got to go. Why? For then shall be Thlipsis Megas. Then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world up until this time, no, nor ever again shall be. Now those are Jesus' own words. That's rough to argue with. He said that not since there was a planet has there been this kind of trouble. Because you know, I teach a pre-tribulation rapture, which is why we're taking the time here to define what the tribulation is. It's impossible to talk about a pre-anything if you don't know what the anything is. So first we're going to talk about what the tribulation is and then continue our proofs about a pre-tribulation rapture. If the pre-tribulation rapture is true, then the spirit of the church is gone, the church itself is gone, and God removes that restraining influence, that salt and light, that, you know, salt was a preservative in the Middle East. You know that when he said, you are salt, he was saying, you are the preservative in the world. When that preservative is gone, and when the Holy Spirit that restrains men is gone, the Bible even says that God restrains the evil of men. He's going to take that hand off and say, go nuts, have at it. And people are going to become as vile as they've ever been or as they're ever going to be. God's going to let him. So he said, there is going to be a time of tribulum, philipsis megas, a time of trouble on the earth such as never was. Now, we can think of some really horrible things that have happened. We can think of Pol Pot. We can think of Hitler. We can think of the time of Domitian or the time of Nero and the killing and destruction of people. We can think of some really horrible things that have happened on planet Earth. Jesus said they're nothing, just a warm-up to what's coming. Which should begin to also give you some sense of why the church can't be here, because it begins with the persecution of the Antichrist, and it ends with the persecution of God pouring out his wrath on everybody on earth. By the time he comes back and pours out his wrath, it says that all the people on the earth run for the dens and the caves, and they say, hide me from the wrath of the Lamb. They don't repent. They don't turn. I've often used that as an example for people who want to say free will. They want to say, well, all a man needs is an adequate inducement, and he'll choose Jesus. All he needs is a good reason, and he'll choose Jesus. You can go up and you just give him a good reason to choose Jesus, and he will. Well, see, when the moon and the stars are darkened, and the sun doesn't give its light anymore, and the moon has become like sackcloth and ashes and blood, when fully half the population of Earth is dead, when the blood is getting ready to run to the bridles of the horses in the Megiddo Plain, when up against that dark sky, Jesus said the Son of Man, the sign of the Son of Man, will be like the lightning is from the east to the west. It's going to light up the whole sky, and it says everyone will see it at the same time, because it will be complete pitch blackness and then the sign in the heavens that he's coming back. Well, see, that's adequate inducement. To me, that's a good reason to choose him then. That's when you choose. That's when you go ahead and you exercise your free will and you say, well, it turns out you're real and I choose you now. No one does. They are in fact so wicked and so evil that they run from him and cry to the rocks and the caves and the dens of the earth and say, fall on us, kill us, and protect us from the wrath of the Lamb. Now, since the language is very specific in that it says everybody on earth does that, can you imagine the church running away from its Lord and saying, hide us from the Lamb? Well, no. So, more importantly, it says that when he comes back with the thousands of his saints. So we come back accompanying him at that point. There will be great tribulation on the earth at that time, such as never was nor ever will be again, ever. By the way, let me give you an alternate translation or an alternate interpretation of that verse so that you will know that there are other versions of that. There are people who do say that when Titus the Roman general marched into Jerusalem and accomplished what Jesus was talking about, the destruction of the temple, and not one stone of the temple on top of another, and there was a huge slaughter in Jerusalem, and the remainder of the Jews were scattered, as they were until 1948, when Israel became a nation again. There are people who say that that was the philipsis megas that Jesus spoke of. That when the temple was destroyed, and when the Jewish religious system was destroyed, that was, for the Jews, the worst thing that could have happened, and is therefore the time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again. Kind of hard to swallow when you look at the 6 million Jews that Hitler killed in the ovens, making lampshades out of the skin of Jewish children. I'm going to go with that's equally as bad, if not worse. And it's hard to believe that a limited skirmish that barely made a blip on the map of Roman domination could somehow be called by Jesus the time of trouble for the earth such as never was or ever would be again. I mean, I would think that the flood when everybody died was worse than the million or so that were killed in Jerusalem at the time of 70 AD. Isn't everybody dying worse than some? And yet Jesus said, time of trouble coming, such as never was or ever would be again. So there is an interpretation out there that says that 70 AD was the fulfillment of that. I disagree, for obvious reasons. But here's where they get tripped up, is verse 22. Jesus then says, and except those days should be shortened, there should be no flesh saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. And people jump up and down and say, see, elect. Jesus said elect right there. That's the church. We're the elect. So the days will be shortened for the elect's sake. Now, they end up in one of two places there. They either say, well, the church was already in existence by 70 AD, and had the persecution in Jerusalem continued out, then all the church would have been persecuted, so Jesus stopped it for the elect's sake. Or they say, there's your proof that the church goes through the tribulation. Time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again, but it'll be shortened for the elect's sake. The elect is the church. There you go, Jim. There's your proof text. The elect go through the tribulation. That's the church goes through the tribulation. Of course, the problem with that, okay, you're shaking your head. So why is that not true, Carol?
Israel, mine elect.
Absolutely. Was there a church when he was saying this? He was saying this to Jewish followers. When he said elect to them, who would they think? They'd think Israel. Historically and scripturally, to this point, the only elect there had ever been was Israel. Anytime Jesus says in the Gospels, mine elect, the people listening to him go, oh, sure, Israel. They never think the church. There is no church. There isn't even Gentile inclusion into the covenant yet. There isn't even a new covenant yet. You understand all that? The new covenant hasn't been brought about yet. There is no inception of the new covenant. There is no Gentile inclusion. There is only Israel, mine elect, which you're quoting from Isaiah 45:4, in which he talks about Israel, my chosen, for Jacob, my elect. And from that point forward, the only elect people you find in Scripture is Israel. So he's just gotten done describing what Israel has to do when Israel sees the abomination of desolation in Judea. Then the Israelites, the Jews that are in Judea, have to flee. They have to worry about whether it's on the Sabbath day, which the church and Gentiles never worried about. And then they are the elect for whom those days will be shortened, or else none of them would survive. And we know they're going to survive. Didn't we just read in Jeremiah 30 last week where he said, though I make an end of all nations, I will not make a complete end of you. Because he's going to shorten the days for their sake. Doesn't that fit nicely? Isn't that a nice cohesive little theology that the Bible presents us with? It's just that folks want to start speculating and going wild with it and creating theories that just can't hold up.
That's an excellent point you make, how he's clearly very Israelitist language, right?
The language is so Jewish.
And then all of a sudden he's going to jump to the church.
Mm-hmm.
From these people would have had a clue who he was talking to. And he was talking to his disciples here. Wasn't like he was talking to the Pharisees in parables or anything.
And did he not use the word church in his speech? He said, I will build my ecclesia, translated church when the King James people got a hold of it. But it means my assembly, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Well, then he knew how to use that word. He didn't use that word. Because the ecclesia of Christ had not yet been formed nor called elect. So he didn't use that word. He used the elect who are Israel in Israelitis context. Okay, so then look, verse 23. So during that time, this time of trouble, if any man shall say to you, lo, here is the Messiah, or over there, don't believe it. Because, of course, at that point, the Jews would be going, oh, man, look at this stuff. Here is the abomination of desolation that Daniel spoke of. The Messiah is going to be here. Let's go find the Messiah. He said, if anybody says he's over there or over there, don't believe them. Because lots of false Christs. Look at verse 24. For there shall arise false Christs, false messiahs, and false prophets, and they shall show great signs and wonders. By the way, false Christs right there, substitute Christ, anti-Christ. He said, there will arise Antichrist and false prophets. And that's exactly what will happen. Antichrist will arise, and the false prophet will give him the power. Jesus forewarned of that. There shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and they shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Don't you love the fact that he said, if it were possible, these miracles would be so good they would deceive the elect. But they won't deceive the elect, the chosen. Why? Because they are the chosen. And by the way, it's not they won't be deceived because they're so smart that they're going to figure it out. It's that they won't be deceived because they are the elect. And I'm going to shorten the days for the elect's sake. I'm going to protect them for 1,260 days over here in Edom and Moab and Ammon, where I've got them in the wilderness. And I'm going to make sure that the Antichrist doesn't touch those areas. And I will protect them because they are mine elect. And he will show such great signs and wonders that if it were possible, they would deceive the very elect. And behold, I've told you all this beforehand. Verse 26. So if they say unto you, behold, he, the Messiah, is in the desert, don't go out there. Or if they say, oh, he's not in an open place like the desert, but he's in the secret chambers, don't believe it. Why? Because as the lightning comes out of the east and shines even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. You got that? When he comes back, it's not going to be, oh, he's hiding in the desert. Remember when the Baha'u'llah? Remember when the Baha'u'llah was here? It was the beginning of that sentence. Like any of you were here in like 1860, 1870. Yes, I remember that, Jim, when Baha'u'llah was around. But the Baha'i faith is built on the premise that Jesus came back, since it says that he would come back in great glory. Baha'u'llah means glory of God, glory of Allah. And so they believe that Jesus did return, just like he said, in the person of the Baha'u'llah, and then spent his life in prison. No, Jesus said, now look, I told you beforehand, there will be false Christs and false prophets come around. And if they say, lo, he's in the desert, don't go out there because I'm not there. And if they say he's in the secret place, he's in prison over in Iran, which is where Baha'u'llah was, don't go, don't believe it, because that's not where I'll be. He says, instead, when I come back, it'll be the same way lightning comes out of the east and shines all the way to the west. In other words, I will take up the whole horizon. The whole sky will be lit up with the brightness of my coming. The book of Joel, repeated by Peter at the day of Pentecost, tells you then what will happen, that the sun and the moon will be darkness and sackcloth, and the moon will become like blood, and the whole sky will be darkened, and then the sign of the Son of Man appears in the sky. And then Revelation, like I said, picks it up, and the people on the earth scatter and run for fear. Which, by the way, yeah, yes, if you see that, if all the stars go dark, and the moon becomes like blood, and the sun doesn't give its light, and then suddenly this bright, shining, streaking object appears in the sky, and it takes on the form of Christ, yeah, you're running. I can see people running. People going, okay, now it's scary, because he's back, and he's not happy.
And I'm still here.
If I knew that. This can't be good for me. I'm still here. Yes. Okay. And by the way, Matthew follows it up with a really interesting comment that he says, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be, and follows it with, for wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles gather together. Well, that's a dark statement. It's not. Jesus is coming back, and he has marshmallows for everyone, and we're going to sing Kumbaya. It's a wonderful moment. It's a beautiful thing. He says, when he comes back, there will be carcasses everywhere. And eagles and birds eating the flesh off the dead. Not a good picture. Look over at Mark, if you would, real quick. 13. 24. And now we're going to start at verse 8. Oh, okay. I have to introduce you to a concept here. Remember in Jeremiah 30 last week, that Jeremiah saw an image of men bent over as if they were in labor, as if they were in pain. Remember that image? And he said, why is it that all men are walking around with, you know, holding their sides and they look like a woman in pain to be delivered? Because the oppression of that time physically will be so hard that no one's going to stand up straight. When the Lord of glory comes back, everyone bends down low. And so he picked a real interesting word here, a Greek word, Odin, O-D-I-N. which actually means pains of labor, distress, and woe that are comparable to the pain that a woman experiences in childbirth. It's a direct parallel to Jeremiah's description of the time of Jacob's trouble. And he picked it up right here. Let's start at verse 5. I know I keep giving you new places, but they've asked him, when are these things going to be? What will be the sign of your coming? What will be the sign of these things being fulfilled? Verse 5, Jesus answered them and said, take heed lest any man deceive you. By the way, why would Jesus have to include that warning? Because people will deceive you, right? Exactly. It's okay to say it out loud, Carol. She mouths the answers just to let me know that she knows what the answer is. But I got an email this week from a woman out in California who said, do you know how different what you're teaching is from everything I've learned? When I read that comment, I thought, yeah, it is. What we're teaching is very different. And one of the things she pointed out is she said, in the end time teachings that I've ever seen, they say that the Antichrist comes up out of Europe, European Union, that kind of stuff. And you're saying it's the Middle East, and you're proving it with the Bible. You're showing me what the Bible really says about it. She says, do you know how different that is? And I do know how different that is, because there aren't a lot of people just letting it say what it says. And even Jesus said, take heed lest any man deceive you, a warning that there will be other versions, other interpretations, and deceptive versions of this information out there. But he took the time to say, just like he did in Matthew, look, I told you beforehand. In other words, you don't have any excuses. Nobody can go, well, you didn't tell us. I go, yeah, I did. I told you everything you needed to know. Take heed lest any man deceive you. Verse 6, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and they shall deceive many. By the way, the word Christ in many of your interpretations there, or I am Messiah, those are all added by the translator. What Jesus actually said right there is, many shall say, I am, which is a very interesting phrase. Many shall make themselves the center of it all, make themselves deity, and shall equate themselves with the I am. And the translators added, I am Christ, which actually waters down what he said. So, and they shall deceive many. Yes. Haven't you? I marvel at how, like, David Koresh got away with what he got away with. Why didn't people just say, well, no, you're going to have to be out there in the desert by yourself? Why would people follow a guy like that? Or Maharishi Ji? Anybody remember Maharishi Ji? I'm fascinated by religious figures. Maharishi Ji here in America and around the world, this was when I was in college, so this goes back to the mid-70s. You know, 13 years old when his mother, well, he was like 9 when his mother announced that he was the incarnation of God, and he was worshipped as such until he got his 22-year-old secretary pregnant when he was like 14, and then his mom said, it's his brother. His brother is the incarnation of God. And people said, well, no, we're not going to go with that one. But why did people follow this Maharishi Ji based on nothing more than his mom saying he's the incarnation of God? Well, okay, lined right up. Sun Myung Moon, why do people follow that guy? Okay, I'll give up everything. Okay, fine. And I do whatever you tell. Fine. I marry whoever you tell me to marry. Fine. I can only have sex once a year and only for procreation, but I can't enjoy it. Okay, I'm all right with that. I mean, why would people think, okay, I'm going with that. Whatever you make up, I'm good with that. People want so badly for somebody to give them something that sounds spiritual that they can hang on to. Because people, by and large, have that big vacuum in them that desperately wants to know something spiritual. I really do think that it's that made in the image of God remnant that's in every human being that's fallen and corrupted and twisted now, but they still desperately want something to fill that void, some spiritual thing. And if they can't find a religion that fills it, then they'll worship Michael Jackson or something. They will find something to worship, even if it's themselves. But they won't worship the real God or the true God. That's just too offensive to their ego.
They also want to know something that somebody else doesn't know.
They want to know something that other people don't know. It makes it feel spiritual. I have Gnostic knowledge that you don't have. Yeah.
And really, Christianity is not that mystical.
It's not. Oh, that's very good. See, I tell people that. I tell people that all the time. That genuine Christianity is not a feeling. It's not an experience. It is fact. Christianity is based on a fact that a man walked around making pronouncements about himself that either make him insane or make him God. And then he said, and I'll prove it and then he proved it. And then Christianity began on the day of Pentecost by Peter standing up and stating facts. This same Jesus, whom you know, he told these people, because they did all know him, shown to be a man of God by the many miracles and the signs and the wonders that he did, which you know. He said, you have with wicked hands killed, but God has raised him up because it was not right that he should be held by death. Just facts. These are facts. He didn't even argue about, now, do you have a feeling about that? Would anyone like to choose him? Or would anybody? And it was just facts. I agree with you. Christianity is all about, these are the facts. Get in line.
Be sober-minded. There's no mystical wiggly stuff when it says be sober-minded.
That's right. Mystical wiggly stuff. I like that phrase. Okay. Now, you see what I just did? I took us off on a tangent that time. Yeah, I chased a rabbit trail that time. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. But see, I can bring me back. That's the difference.
Right? That's an important distinction.
Yes, yeah, I agree with you. I'm with you on that one. Verse 7. You will hear about wars and rumors of war, but be not troubled, for such things must needs be. But the end is not yet. Remember all Daniel's language about the end, the end. The end. They're asking, when's going to be the end? Yeah, you'll see wars, rumors of wars. In Matthew, we even listed famines, earthquakes, floods. You're going to see all that. And he said, but these are just the birth pangs. For nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. By the way, nation against nation is actually the Greek ethnos, from which we get ethnic or ethnicity. Ethnos against ethnos. People of a racial group against people of a racial group. That was happening all over the planet. Kingdom against kingdom. There shall be earthquakes in diverse places, and there shall be famines and troubles, but these are the beginning of, and the word sorrows there is that Greek word I told you, Odin. These are the beginning of birth pain. He used that same Jeremiah language to say that all the wars, the rumors of war, the trouble, all the stuff we're seeing right now, he said, that's not the end. That's just the birth pangs. That's just the beginning of what's coming. So all this stuff we've seen, all the buildup, all the Hitlers, all the Pol Pots, all the death, all the destruction, all the famine, all the everything you can think of that's bad in the earth, all the floods, all the stuff, all that stuff, he said, that ain't it yet. That's not the tribulation yet. He said, those are just the birth pangs of what's coming. Scary, huh? Okay, we're going to have to move fast. Here we go. The day of the Lord. This period of trouble is made doubly worse by the fact that not only does the little horn inflict persecution on Israel and the surrounding kingdoms, but as he lifts himself up to the position of deity, God intervenes and begins pouring out his wrath on the inhabitants of the earth for the rejection of his son and their proclivity towards sin. That period when God begins his work of punishing sin is called the day of the Lord, and it's truly a time unlike any time that has gone before it. Turn quickly to Ezekiel 7. We won't get to all the verses I want to get to tonight, but I thought maybe I could leave you with this very dark sense and feeling, and you could carry it through the holidays. And then, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am.
So they'll be punished for their sins at this time, and then when they go to hell, they'll be punished more.
We're talking about two different things.
Okay, never mind. It's okay. You can move on.
But that's okay, because it's a reasonable question. Do men die physically because they're sinners?
Yes.
Yes. Do some men who die because they're sinners also go to hell?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. So it's really no different here. It's just that God comes back and kills them all and then judges them for their sin. And now the distinction is, that's why I said you're talking about two different things. The distinction with Israel is, he said, I'm going to come back and punish you the way a father punishes you, but I won't make a full end of you. To punish them for their proclivity for sin and their rejection of his son.
Yeah.
He's coming back to straighten that all out.
Okay, I was thinking.
But not to destroy them.
Yeah, no, I got it.
No, okay. Because they are the elect. I'm in Ezekiel 7. I'm starting at verse 2. I'm going to read through verse 19. I'm just going to read all the way through it just because it is one of the darker passages that you're going to find in the Bible. But here's how Ezekiel saw this time of trouble coming. At the beginning of this, when he says, also, son of man, he's speaking to Ezekiel. Also, Ezekiel, thus saith the Lord God unto the land of Israel. An end. The end. is come upon the four corners of the land. Now is the end come upon thee, and I will send my anger upon thee, and I will judge thee according to thy ways, and I will recompense upon thee all thine abominations. And my eye shall not spare thee, neither will I have pity, but I will recompense your ways upon you, and your abominations shall be in the midst of you. And you shall know that I am the Lord. So why is he doing all this? For his glory, yes. So they will know I am the Lord. You'll have no other gods before me. They had other gods. Okay, I'll be back. You'll keep my Sabbath day and you'll keep it holy. Nah, we'll keep any day we want. I'll be back. Here's my son. Hear ye him. Oh, nail him to a cross. I'll be back. And now he's back. And that phrase, my eye will not spare you, and I won't have pity. We like to think, and we read a lot about God's mercy and grace and his pity on us, because he knows that we're but dust, he understands our frame, all that kind of language. God says when he comes back here, none of that. Just the unadulterated wrath of God. Without pity, without sparing. Thus saith the Lord God, an evil, an only evil, behold, is come. See that language? He said it twice just so you'd understand it. An evil, an only evil. This is a time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again. It is a time of evil from God that is the only evil he's going to pour out this way. Then, just so you'd understand what kind of evil, an end is come, the end is come, and it watches for you, and behold, it is come. That's just dark. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. Now will I shortly pour out my fury upon you, and I will accomplish my anger upon you, and I will judge you according to your ways, and I will recompense thee for all thine abominations, and my eye shall not spare, neither will I have pity, and you shall know that I am the Lord that smites. Did you get that? I am the Lord that beats you. Smites. You never hear that one. You always hear God is love. Right? God is love. God named himself here with the name, I am the Lord that smites. Yeah, well, that's why Peter would say our God is a consuming fire. Yeah, those are all characteristics of God. And if you truncate those characteristics in favor of just saying God is love, that's like if somebody only took one facet of your personality, Tiffany, and then defined you by that one aspect, and every time they saw you or talked to you or acted or talked about you or anything else, they only talked about that facet of you. Wouldn't that get old after a while? That's what people do with God. God is love. And then everything else they say about God, they move through that filter of God is love. And they come away with a God of their own imagination because they think that's all he is love. And then they define their theology based on God is love. They haven't read the whole revelation of who God says he is. And here's God saying, I am the Lord. See the capital L-O-R-D? That is, I am Yahweh. That is the pronoun name of God. I am Yahweh that smites. And he wants you to know that. Violence is risen up into a rod of wickedness. None of them shall remain, nor of their multitude, nor any of theirs, neither shall there be any wailing or crying for them. They have blown the trumpet even to make ready, but none of them will go to the battle, for my wrath is upon all the multitude thereof. You see that? They gather for the war. They blow the trumpet. Everybody gets together. And he says, and not a one of them will make it to the battlefield. I'll kill them all before they get there. You don't come fight with me. You can gather for the battle, but you won't make it. That notion is the very notion that Jesus picked up that Matthew was talking about when he said, where the carcass is, that's where the eagles are gathered. Because we're going to see later that when he talks about two in a bed, one's taken, the other's left, two in a field, one's taken, the other left, in Mark, they ask him, where, Lord, where are they taken? Jesus says that same thing you saw in Matthew. He says, wherever the carcass is, that's where the eagles are gathered. In other words, they're all being called together to the war. They're all being called together to Megiddo. All the armies of the earth are going to get together and go fight against God and against his son and against his anointed. The kings of the earth will gather together to fight against his anointed. This is old news that the whole world, the corrupt world, is finally going to say, that's it, blow the trumpet, let's go to war, let's go fight. And he'll say, before they ever reach the battlefield, boom. The sword is outside, and the pestilence and the famine are inside. He that is in the field will die by the sword. He that is in the city will die from the famine and the pestilence that shall devour him. But they that escape of them shall escape and shall be on the mountains like doves of the valleys. These are those, again, the Israelites that are going to go to the valley. They're going to go in the wilderness. They're going to go to the mountains, Edom, Ammon, Moab. All of them will be there in mourning, every one of them, for their iniquity. All hands shall be feeble. All knees shall be weak as water. And they also shall gird themselves with sackcloth, and horror shall cover them. Shame shall be on all their faces, and baldness upon all their heads. And they shall cast their silver and their gold in the streets. Their silver will be in the streets. Their gold will be removed. Their silver and their gold shall not be able to deliver them in the day of the wrath of the Lord. There's nothing you can do. He's back and he's angry. There's nothing anybody can do. The richest man on the earth will be going, Bill Gates will be going, money don't matter anymore. It's not about money anymore because he's back. Let me show you one more. Run over quickly to the book of Joel. Look at a couple of verses out of Joel, and then we'll get to some of the other minor prophets, Amos and Zephaniah, in a couple weeks. There's a lot about this in the Bible, is my point. You know, Jesus said, and it's recorded in the book of John, Jesus said, you must be born again. One time to a guy. And I agree with that phrase completely. You must be born again. I agree with that. Except that whole denominations have been built and whole theologies have been constructed around you must be born again. The whole born again movement around you must be born again. How much of this Day of the Lord stuff is there in the Bible? You ever hear about it? No. And it permeates the Bible. It's all over the place. But nobody wants to talk about the God that judges and the God who has wrath and the God who will defend his own character and the God who will defend his own righteousness and glory and the fact that men are completely disposable to God if they do not serve his glory. All men will either serve his glory in their salvation by grace or he will serve their glory in his destruction of them. Either way, his glory is served. In the end, everybody says, you're right, you're God. And that's God's purpose. Until you see it through God's eyes, you'll always come away with a fallacious notion of who God is and how he works. Everybody find the book of Joel, first chapter? Starting at verse 13. We're just going to look at 13, 14, 15 here. Gird yourselves and lament, you priests. Yeah, the priests of Israel, not going to be able to help. Howl, you ministers of the altar. Everybody, all the Levites that are working in the temple thinking they're serving God. It's going to be wailing and howling, it says. Come lie all night in sackcloth, ye ministers of my God, for the meat offering and the drink offering is withheld from the house of God. Why? Because there isn't anything to eat. There isn't anything to drink. Sanctify ye a fast. Call a solemn assembly. Gather the elders and all the inhabitants of the land into the house of the Lord your God and cry unto the Lord, alas, for the day of the Lord is at hand, and as a destruction from the Almighty shall it come. There's that day of the Lord language again. The day of the Lord is a time of destruction. Go down a couple of verses. Joel 2, verses 1 and 2. Blow ye the trumpet in Zion. Sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble. For the day of the Lord comes, for it is now close at hand. It is nigh at hand in the King James. A day of darkness and of gloominess, a day of clouds and of darkness, thick darkness. As the morning spread upon the mountains, a great people and a strong. There hath not been ever like it, neither shall be any more after it, even to the years of many generations. Now we've got Daniel, Jeremiah, Joel, and Jesus all saying this is a time such as never was or ever will be again. Joel 2, starting in verse 7. Neither shall one thrust another. They shall walk every one in his path. And when they fall upon the sword, they shall not be wounded. Okay, now what this is, in the book of Revelation, and we'll get to it, God sends down the angel Michael, who has a key to the bottomless pit, the abyss. And he goes down to the river Euphrates, and he goes to the bottomless pit, and he opens it, and there are demons that have been held there since the book of Genesis. We'll get to all this. And they're let go. They were put in there because they're so bad. They're let out. And they are sent to torment the people on earth, who the book of Revelation says will beg and cry and plead and desire death. God won't let them die. That's harsh. Because they think, well, the only way out is death. I'll get out of this. I'll die. Here he says they'll fall on their own sword and they won't be wounded. Try to kill themselves to get out of it. I want out. That's how bad it's going to be. They shall run to and fro in the city, and they shall run upon the wall, and they shall climb up upon the houses, and they shall enter in at the windows like a thief, and the earth shall quake before them, and the heavens shall tremble, and the sun and the moon shall be dark, and the stars shall withdraw their shining, and the Lord shall utter his voice before his army, for his camp is very great. Who's that? That's us. For he is strong that executes his words. For the day of the Lord is great and very terrible, and who can abide it? Isn't that dark language? My goodness. People running, hiding, running to and fro, hiding, running up walls, anything they can to escape it. But they can't escape the day of the Lord. Why? Because he is strong that executes his word. The Almighty is executing his word, and nobody can escape it. For the day of the Lord is great and very terrible, and who can abide it? You got time for one more? See if you can find Amos, minor prophet right there by Joel.
How long is his day?
Huh?
3.5 years.
3. Yeah, well, the 3.5 years is broken down a bit, but yes, the second 3.5 of the 7 years falls under that big day of the Lord kind of heading, or tribulation heading. But it begins with the persecution of the Antichrist, which we haven't gotten to yet, and taking the mark of the beast and all that stuff. And then toward the end of that 3.5 years, when Jesus returns, is all this stuff. So when you say, how long is it? We don't know for sure. Liz is right. It falls into the last 3.5 years. The first 3.5 years of the 7-year pact is completely peaceful. He brings peace to the world, and everybody goes, this is a great guy. 3.5 years into it, he breaks with that peace. The armies are coming to him from China. The armies are coming to him down from Russia and down from Turkey. He's having trouble out of Africa. There's all sorts of problems coming around the Middle East at that point. He then completely takes over as dictator in that area, sets up the abomination that makes desolate, sends the Jews on the run, starts the mass killing of Israelites. And so they're all gathering there for the great war with him. And once they all gather around Megiddo and that area, Iran, Iraq, that area of the world, once they all start gathering there, then God comes back and starts with wiping them out and then turns his attention to Israel and begins his chastisement for them, introducing the millennial period. And Ezekiel 39, which we won't get to, Ezekiel 39 says that for the first 7 months, the Israelites who were left spend their time picking up bones from the destruction that's left in their land. They spend the first 7 months of the millennium just cleaning the land of all the destruction, the human destruction. So there's a lot to be said here. Everybody find Amos? Amos 5. Amos 5, starting in verse 16. Therefore the Lord, Yahweh, the God of hosts. Have you ever heard the word Sabaoth? Mm-hmm. It's not Sabbath. Sabaoth comes from the Hebrew word that is translated here, God of hosts. So he's making sure you understand who he's dealing with. First he says, therefore the Lord, capital letters, Yahweh, who is the Lord of hosts, or the God of hosts, which means that he is the one who controls all the hosts of heaven and earth. He's the one in control of everything. The Lord, he wants you to make sure, now he's got three says this, wailing shall be in all the streets, and they shall say in all the highways, alas, alas. and they shall call the husbandmen to mourning, and such as are skillful in lamentation will be called to wailing. And in all vineyards shall there be wailing, for I will pass through thee, says the Lord. Woe unto you that desire the day of the Lord! To what end is it for you? The day of the Lord is darkness and not light. It's as if a man did flee from a lion and a bear ate him. Or he went into a house, he leaned his hand on a wall and a serpent bit him. Shall not the day of the Lord be darkness and not light, even very dark and no brightness in it? The picture Amos wanted people to see was there's no escape. It's like a man going, ah, lion, and runs straight into the jaws of a bear. Or a man who runs into a house thinking he's protected, and as soon as he leans against the wall, there's a serpent on the wall to bite him and kill him. There's nowhere to hide, is the picture. Last one, find Zephaniah, right there behind Amos. See if you can find Zephaniah real quick. I promise this is the last one. It's a natural place to end, though. Zephaniah 1, starting at verse 14. The great day of the Lord is near. It is near. It hastens greatly. Even the voice of the day of the Lord, the mighty man shall cry there bitterly. That day is a day of wrath, a day of trouble and distress, a day of wasteness and desolation, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of the trumpet and alarm against the fenced cities and against the high towers. And I will bring distress upon men, and they shall all walk like blind men, because they have sinned against the Lord, and their blood shall be poured out like dust, and their flesh shall be as dung. Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of the Lord's wrath, but the whole land shall be devoured by the fire of his jealousy, for he shall make even a speedy riddance of all them that dwell in the land. There's a God you don't hear about much. Going to make a speedy riddance of all them that are in his land. Now, by the way, I want you to know that what I just read you just scratch the surface of what's in here. I've just shown you the minor prophets and Ezekiel. We just scratched it. But you need to know that that's all in there so that when you get to the book of Revelation, you go, ah, this language is familiar to me. The prophets have already predicted all this stuff. Oh, I see where this all fits. And then you understand why when the church was conceived at the inception of the church, in the beginning of the book of Acts, Peter stands up and quotes from Joel. And he quotes the darkest passage of Joel he could find that includes the day of the Lord, because he was speaking by the Spirit. And he says, this is that which was spoken of. And then he goes off into, your young men will dream dreams, your old men will see visions. And then just like Joel does, he leaps right to the end time and says, and the moon and the stars will become like sackcloth and ashes and blood. Day of destruction. Because that's the picture. So, Old Covenant, New Covenant, beginning of the church, end of the Bible. Doesn't matter where you go in here. This picture is all over the place that God is not going to, as God said of himself, he said, my spirit will not always strive with men. There will be a point where he'll go, that's it. I'm done. And he takes his own, he takes his elect, he hides the remnant of Israel like he's always done. He takes his church away, and then he just pours out wrath, which is a way that we don't think of God, but he's going to do it, or the Bible's a lie. But that's a risk I'm not willing to take. Yes, ma'am.
You know, what's interesting about the people who believe amillennial eschatology is when you think about the fact of all the things the Lord did on the earth. I mean, he died on the earth, he became a baby, he humbled himself. Why would he not eventually rule it physically from being here? That's the whole thing.
You think exactly like I do. Plus, all of the language concerning the kingdom is all physical language.
Well, I mean, and why wouldn't he be the king in the temple?
Of course. Sure he would be.
He made it, he's running it, and he's going to leave us.
Right. Well, you know that it comes from the fact that once you start spiritualizing, once you see the introduction of allegorical preaching, if you watch the history and development of theology from the time of the apostles to the early church fathers to the time of Constantine and the introduction of that kind of method of interpretation, there was so much anti-Jewish feeling at that period that there were all these promises for Israel hanging out in the Old Testament, both promises of punishment and promises of restoration and kingdom and all that stuff, that there was no more Israel. You know, 70 AD, it had been destroyed. By the time you get to the time of Constantine and the beginning, really, of systematic allegorical interpretation of Scripture, that's a good 300 years from the apostles. It's longer than we've been a nation. And look how much we've changed our interpretation of the founding documents of this country. What did the founding fathers write, and what do we think it means 200 years later? Well, so put 300 years on all these promises, with Gentiles going around saying, well, now God has scattered Israel, and he's scattered the Jews, and he knocked down his temple, he's clearly done with them. What do we do with all these promises? We start allegorizing. And once you start down that road of allegorizing, then you end up allegorizing everything, and you're right. You come away with this peculiar amillennial kind of thought that says that Jesus is going to rule and reign on David's throne in heaven, even though that doesn't make sense. You'll come away.
He's already man. It's not like, you know, he's going to come in some other bodily form. I
really genuinely don't get it. There are a lot of people that believe that stuff, and but I honestly do not get it. If you'll look at what the Bible says, and you'll do it systematically, if you'll pay the same kind of attention, this is the complaint I've had with my Reformed friends and brethren, is that they are so systematic when they do their soteriology. How do men get saved? 5 points of Calvinism. Very systematic. Here's the proof text. Here's the way it flows. Here's what Paul said. Here's blah, blah, blah. And then they get to their eschatology, and instead of being systematic like what we're doing here, which will drive you to a conclusion and drive you to a position, instead instead of being systematic at all, they just start making stuff up, and it makes me crazy. But if you'll pay attention to the systematics that the Bible presents you, there's only one conclusion you can come to. So I like the inescapable conclusions. That's why I'm convinced of my position and am willing to defend it.
Just one other question, though. You said that where was that verse about the rocks, the cry, the rocks and hills
falling? Revelation 6:15, and the kings of the earth and the great men and the rich men and the chief captains and the mighty men and every slave and every free man. That's a pretty complete list. I mean, you can see that John is clearly trying to say everybody.
Right.
Hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and they said to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? That language is pretty familiar now, isn't it? There you go. You read it from Revelation, you go, oh, well, I've been seeing that all through the Old Testament. Okay, so. All right, turn it off. Let's go. That's it. Thanks for your patience tonight.